I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and archived on TVTimeMachine.com. We're back again with Karen Herman and Jenny Matz of the Archive of American Television right here on the TV Time Machine. Now, some of your most fascinating interviews are with the show creators and producers, as in the case of Leonard Stern, creator of many TV shows and executive producer of the classic 1960s spy spoof, Get Smart.
The only comment I had from the network when they saw the pilot was a note that told me to change Don Adams' strident delivery. That was negated by an imitation of Don Adams done by one of the astronauts on the first moon flight, when something went wrong, said, "Sorry about that, Chief." Within 4 weeks, everybody was doing their version of Maxwell Smart's voice.
Jenny, for people who may not be familiar with Mr. Stern's work, what was he involved in over the past 50 years in television?
Wow.
Just a couple of things.
Yeah, well, let's see. He was a head writer on The Honeymooners. I believe he was a head writer. He wrote for the $64 question right. In the 40s. I mean, he's been around. He wrote for the Abbott Costello radio show, Broadway Open House, writing for the Jackie Gleason show. He worked with Jackie Gleason for a long time. And, of course, as you mentioned, Get Smart, and he developed the show I'm Dickens, He's Fenster, Macmillan and Wife. Karen, am I missing anybody?
He also wrote for the Steve Allen Show.
Of course.
And the Phil Silver Show.
Right, yeah.
And that's the amazing thing about these guys, Leonard Stern and Bill Dana, they all seem interconnected, like they came from the same neighborhood. It's really amazing how you have those 6 degrees of separation always occurring.
Yeah, and it's, also another interesting thing that people might not know about that time period is that there were much fewer writers on a show than there are now, which they marvel at.
Right.
When they see people go up to get their Emmy Awards and there's about 20 writers who follow them. In those days, for example, the Steve Allen Show, there was only, at one time, Bill was the only writer. And then there was maybe 4 or 5 people in writing teams of two later, but they really operated on a much smaller staff, and so they all knew each other really intimately, and they'd work on the same shows together, and one would hire another when they got a new show, and there was a lot of sharing of material and sharing of talents, and the friendships from those early days of the 50s, specifically in television's history, that they really carry on, and you'll see the same names producing a show, writing a show, directing a show, and it's because of those really strong working friendships, I think. And they all still talk to each other, which is amazing. I went to a roast at the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters Association, and it was Hal Cantor and Tom Poston and Leonard Stern and Bill Dana, and all these people are still buddies.
Right.
So that's neat to see.
Who generally, Karen, has a better memory for what happened years ago? Actors or technicians?
In terms of the writers and technicians, I would say definitely them. I think they're a lot more in tune. And also, Jean Stapleton actually said this, that when you're when you're in the character, you're in the character. But then once that job is over, it sort of leaves your mind and you go on to the next thing.
Right.
So it's very different. I mean, they live with the characters within that space, but then in order to do a really good performance in the next thing that they're doing, they kind of have to let that go. And a writer will actually kind of keep it in and hopefully use it again for something else that they're doing in their next work.
Now, many of the folks you chat with are indeed pioneers in their respective fields, and no less an example is Phyllis Diller, as we'll hear in this clip.
Comic actresses were my inspiration in my childhood. Those wonderful, old, wonderful movies with the comic actresses, many of them. And in this case, some of them were pretty. It was okay to be pretty in the movies. A comic actress can be pretty. But hardcore comic stand-up whole other thing. You work in one, you work alone, and you don't use props. You see, I started out using props. Now, in order to become a stand-up, which was my goal, I had to get rid of the props. And remember, they're just that. They're crutches. They prop you up.
Jenny, what kind of pioneer was Phyllis Diller?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, she's still, you know, any female comedian working today will say Phyllis Diller was an inspiration for paving the way. I mean, she's a genderless icon, but she was one of the first women pioneers to do stand-up and to, you know, not be a pretty face, as she's saying, and just to really just be real. Still funny, still totally respected within the comic world, and I mean, how do you top Phyllis? I mean, she is, oh, and always will be a legend.
Yeah, not only that, but it also shows how much thought she put into what she did and how she's able to dissect that. Because it wasn't just, oh, I'm going to throw this out, or she really examined what she had to do, and then she did it.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think that's what is conveyed in the interviews that you do, because I think a lot of people take entertainers for granted, and they don't realize the amount of thought that they put into their craft. But that's revealed in your interviews.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, I know we're going to get into this later, but one of the very revealing things in the interview with George Carlin was the epiphany he had when he was doing his routine on The Ed Sullivan Show, and the act was very mainstream, and he literally had an epiphany while working the room at the Copacabana and said, this isn't me, and how do I turn the person I am into the comedy that I'm doing? And really went about completely metamorphosizing into a rebel comic from a very mainstream one.
Well, our next interview example reminds us that TV legends are not confined to entertainment, as we'll hear in this example featuring TV evangelist Tammy Faye Baker.
I didn't feel I was famous. Just never thought about it. I still don't today. It's not one of the things that is ever uppermost on my mind.
Were you involved in the business?
No, never.
Eventually there was the scandal. Can you talk a little about that?
No, I won't talk about that.
Okay. But how did your life change after that, after it was gone?
After it was gone, it was very sad. We lived a very sad existence. I prayed to die. I prayed that God would take our whole family home, but now that's a prayer that I'm glad he didn't listen to.
What was the experience with Tammy Faye Baker? How did that go?
That was pretty intense. What people don't know is that literally she had been in the hospital that morning, and it was right before her last bout with lung cancer, and she was in terrible pain. But she's a trooper, and she wanted to do the interview, so we actually sat down and did it. So it was very poignant. In that sense, and she, we kind of knew she wasn't going to talk about the scandal, but she did talk about it. And what, the reason that we get the televangelists, you know, we have Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, and is because they probably have been able to harness the power of television the most out of anyone. I mean, they really took very small ministries and created, you know, empires of religious television. So that's one of the reasons why people are like, oh, why do you have these people? But it they really exemplify what you can do with television.
So for somebody like Tammy Faye Baker, when you set up your interviews, who establishes the guidelines and ground rules for what will be asked and discussed?
Well, basically, I mean, it really differs from person to person. I mean, we're very open, and we say, you know, we're going to ask you about your life and career. We are going to talk about the focus will be television. Tammy did not say before the interview, no, we will not talk about this. I mean, we had an inkling that would probably be the case, but you know, our responsibility is to ask the question. And if there's a question that they don't want to answer, this also applies to a lot of people who are involved in the blacklist and McCarthyism. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to answer the question, they can just say pass, but it is our responsibility to ask it.
Jenny, have you ever had a situation that really got uncomfortable, that you went into territory that somebody really didn't want to talk about?
Ooh, No, I don't think so. But I have been surprised what people did talk about. I interviewed last year Ralph Baruch, who is the founder, president, CEO of Viacom, an executive at CBS for many, many years. Real powerful guy. And he was just started telling a very personal story about the Holocaust and how his family escaped through the mountains. Very emotional. And then he went on later in his career. He was, by his account, stabbed in the back by someone who he really entrusted to be like a son to him. And very open and very forthcoming. And we didn't know how he would talk about that instance, which had been in the press and there had been some tabloid news about. But I'm always surprised that people do find it almost like a relief to talk about things that perhaps the press got wrong or were misunderstood by people before. And we really give them a platform in which to explain it all, because we don't cut these. They're not edited down. They're there for posterity, for really them to tell their story. So I can't think of, I'm sure there is one, but I right now can't think of a time when someone got upset that a question was asked of them. But I'll come back to you if I remember.
Do you find that sometimes people forget that they're on camera? and they just start saying things that maybe, you know, they, you know, if they realize, oh, I'm being filmed.
I think that has happened to me before when you get into some of the more philosophical conversations with people about things that happened to them in their life, in their career, and you really are in a conversation with the person. It's like you're in their home, they're telling you something very personal, and maybe they do forget the camera's there. Maybe their press agent later will remember. But from personal experience, I know the conversation we had with George Carlin, I did feel that way, that he just was speaking to us. And he did not look at the camera. He was looking at me and my co-interviewer, Henry. And I didn't think like there was anyone else in the room at all. And that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's happened to me a lot, too, actually. And, you know, I get a lot of people saying after the interview, oh, my gosh, you know more about me and my life than my kids do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But for the most part, people are pretty open, because, I mean, if they're going to commit to being on camera for an archival interview, they know that there's a certain expectation that they're going to have to talk about a lot of stuff.
Has anyone ever said something that they later regretted and asked you to delete it, edit it out?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, so that has happened. That has happened.
Yes, it has. Mm-hmm. It has. It's very rare, but it has. What we do is we'll say, you know what, if this is really historically important, and a lot of times it is, we'll say, can we please not destroy it, but can we keep it and what we call time capsuling, and maybe release it either after your death or in the next 20 or 30 years, but it doesn't have to be released right now. But if it's historically important, we do make the argument that we'd really like to somehow keep this for posterity. And most of the time, we do get an agreement.
Well, we mentioned this earlier. One of the more fascinating aspects of your interviews is when TV legends reveal their true feelings and philosophy regarding their craft, as we'll hear in this clip.
When I decided to go into making McHale's Navy, people said, why are you lowering yourself? Lowering myself? What do you mean lowering? It's all show business, isn't it? I mean, whether you're in front of a small camera or a big camera, it makes no difference. You're still entertainment. It's any way you look at it, it's entertainment. Even if you're on a stage, you're still working in front of something, somebody. And so it's all entertainment. How can you be lowering yourself by in your standards? I couldn't get that at all.
Jenny, that was your interview with Ernest Borgnine. What was that like, and what kind of guy was he?
Oh, my
or
God.
Or is he?
He is just the very ebullient, wonderful personality you would expect. There's, like, no distinction between anything you've seen of him on talk shows or, you know, his roles on TV, film. He just is the most charming man. We had the best time at that interview, and he didn't want us to leave. I mean, he took us on a tour of his house after, and he was just so excited we were there. And he had so many, I mean, what an amazing film career. As he said, he didn't have any trouble making the transition into TV. And he actually, before he went into that, I think he had an anecdote about why he actually took Mikhail's Navy was there was a Boy Scout who came to his house, and he said, "Oh, I know you're someone famous, but who are you?" And Borgnine said, "Well, guess." And he named another actor who was on television.
Wow.
And then Borgnine said, "Okay, I'll call my agent. I'm doing TV." Because the kid had no idea who he was, even though he's an Oscar-winning film actor.
Right.
Just such a giving, generous spirit. Love Borgie.
Well, was there anything about that interview that surprised you in terms of his interests or...
There were two things. There was he was telling a lot of stories about the film work he had done, and what struck me was that everyone seemed to end in him making the director of that film cry.
Oh my God.
not because of something upsetting that happened, but just of the pure emotion he would bring to the role. He's worked with Delbert Mann, and he's worked with all these amazing, directors, but it seemed to be this recurring theme. And you can hear all the stories. I can't remember exactly the details, but every single one he made the director cry. And then, following the interview, he gave us this tour, and we stumbled upon a room that was like from the Civil War, and it was all themed on Abraham Lincoln. And I asked about it, and then he got so excited we were curious. So he told us the whole story about how he had found a portrait of Abraham Lincoln at a garage sale.
Wow.
And bought it because he just was a kind of a history buff. But then he later had it appraised, and it turned out that Abraham Lincoln had sat for that portrait.
That's amazing.
So he built an entire room in his home based around this portrait that had touched or been in the presence of one of America's presidents, and that was kind of cool. I don't think anyone would know that about Borgie. So that was a fun day.
It pays to go to garage sales.
Yes, it does. You would be surprised.
Well, we're going to have to take a little break, but we'll be back in a moment with Karen Herman and Jenny Matz of the Archive of American Television, who are traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.